The following program contains graphic material, including offensive language. Viewer discretion is advised.
She's got the news. She talks with newsmakers. She encourages us to laugh, and she cries with us. Speaking truth to power and questioning authority daily, it's the Nicole Sandler Show.
All right, welcome to a Wednesday. Busy, busy Wednesday at that. There's a lot of ground to cover. Later on in the show, we're going to check in with an author named John M. Barry. John Barry was on the show almost exactly a year ago. It was May 6th of 2020. Today's May 12th. And the reason he was on the show back in May 6th of 2020 is, well, for a few reasons. One is he had an op-ed in the Washington Post about COVID, about the pandemic. And the reason it was noteworthy is because John M. Barry is the author of a book called, and I want to give you the exact title, The Great Influenza, The Story of the Deadliest Pandemic in History. And that was the 1918 Spanish flu. And so he's a historian, so he knows, all the particulars around that pandemic. And I thought, a year ago, I wanted to get his take on what we were in store for already a couple of months into the thing. Now, he had another op-ed in the Washington Post just this past Monday. The headline read, "The 1918 pandemic tells us that we can't celebrate the end of COVID yet." And I agree. So I invited him back on the show, and we'll hear that conversation a little later in the hour. I want to start, though, because today was a busy, busy day. It started with Liz Cheney being voted by the Republican conference, the House Republican caucus, out of her number three position in leadership, in Republican Party leadership in the House. She was the conference chair, which honestly doesn't mean a whole lot. I can't even tell you what the position entails, other than in terms of power in the Republican House caucus. She was number three behind Kevin McCarthy and Steve Scalise, two ick kind of people, if I ever saw any. In fact, Kevin McCarthy, boy, he's a special kind of creepy, but we'll get to him in a minute. So Liz Cheney, so they have the vote. So last night, Liz Cheney did this. I thought I pulled it up here. I guess I didn't. Let's see if I have it handy here. Liz Cheney delivered a speech last night on the floor of the House. It was around 8 o'clock or so, maybe a little later. And I'll tell you what's really sad is once she got up to speak, all of her colleagues got up and left. Are they 12? I mean, I'm grasping for words here. The lack of couth. I know that's not a word, but bear with me. Uncouth is, and that's what they are. It's just horrible. Now, again, let me state up front, I'm no fan of Liz Cheney or her daddy. I don't agree with her on a single issue, but I do have newfound respect for her for standing up, telling the truth, and doing the right thing. So I can separate the two. Don't like her as a person, don't like her stance on anything, don't agree with her on anything, but I really appreciate the fact that she's standing up and telling the truth about Donald Trump, because she's almost single-handedly, well, there's two of them, her and Adam Kinzinger, are the only ones willing to stand up when you know full well that there are a lot of members of that Republican House caucus who know the truth. They just are more concerned with keeping their jobs than they are with letting the American democracy continue. So, I thought, all right, so they're going to have a secret ballot. It's going to be a private vote. And yeah, there were no cameras in the conference meeting that got underway this morning shortly after 9 o'clock. And So no cameras were allowed in, and they weren't in for very long. And when they came out, we found out, yes, they indeed voted to strip Liz Cheney of her leadership position. But they didn't do, there was no tally of the votes. They did it by voice vote. Could anything be more chicken shit than that? You know, a secret ballot is one thing, but at least you would know what the count is, right? It could be, say there are 110, that's wishful thinking on my part, member Republicans in the House. There's more than that, but I'm just throwing out that number. Well, we could know that, you know, 60 voted to oust her and 50 voted to keep her. And I have a feeling it was along those lines if they voted on a secret ballot. But they didn't even do that. They did a voice vote. So we don't have a count of who was for her, who was against her. That's really shitty, too. Everything about this is shitty. Liz Cheney's speech last night, though, wasn't. I was kind of impressed. I'm not going to play the whole thing for you. The whole thing ran only about 6 minutes. I'll tell you what, I'll embed it on the blog today where, you know, I post the day show every day, both the audio version, the video, any links to guests and information that you need. And, you know, if I play a funny video or something, I always embed that there. I will put the Liz Cheney full 6 minute speech from last night. Yeah, the first 2.5 minutes you can fast forward through because she didn't say anything consequential there. But then she got into it. Again, I'm only going to share about 30 seconds of it with you. And when she said this.
Remaining silent and ignoring the lie emboldens the liar. I will not participate in that. I will not sit back and watch in silence while others lead our party down a path that abandons the rule of law and joins the former president's crusade to undermine our democracy. Mm-hmm. We must speak the truth. Our election was not stolen, and America has not failed.
Wow. Wow. For a Republican to stand up and say that. And so the vote was over. Immediately, Liz Cheney leaves the room. There are cameras waiting outside from C-SPAN. She goes up to the camera. Here's a little bit, again, of what she said. I'm not going to play the whole thing. But here's her fighting spirit after the vote in which she was stripped of her position in the caucus.
The nation needs it. The nation needs a strong Republican Party. The nation needs a party that is based upon fundamental principles of conservatism. And I am committed and dedicated to ensuring that that's how this party goes forward, and I plan to lead the fight to do that. I will do everything I can to ensure that the former president never again gets anywhere near the Oval Office. We have seen
like
the danger that he continues to provoke with his language. We have seen his lack of commitment and dedication to the Constitution. And I think it's very important that we make sure whomever we elect is somebody who will be faithful to the Constitution.
Okay, so good for her. I mean, you know, someone's got to do it. And I'm glad it's someone as tough as Liz Cheney. Again, I don't like her, but she's a tough cookie. And she's going to run for re-election. She might have a big fight on her hands because there in Wyoming, you know, the crazy is thick. So that happened. You know, Kevin McCarthy, who I said is just a weasel, just a real, ugh. You know, you got to remember a couple of days after, I forget the exact date, but it was shortly after the January 6th insurrection, Kevin McCarthy gets up on the House floor and says this.
The president bears responsibility for Wednesday's attack on Congress by mob rioters.
Yep.
He should have immediately denounced the mob when he saw what was unfolding. These facts require immediate action by President Trump. Accept his share of responsibility, quell the brewing unrest, and ensure President-elect Biden is able to successfully begin his term.
Wow. I mean, that came after Lindsey Graham said, I'm done. I'm out. I just can't anymore. Yeah. It, you know, and then what a difference phone call from Donald Trump makes, I guess, because what they've learned is you go against Trump and he will smear you. He will run you over. He'll take his creepy star status and turn the masses against you. And so these people have realized, if I want to keep my job, then I have to suck up to Trump. And Kevin McCarthy did just that. We know that shortly after that, he was on Trump's shit list. He flew down to West Palm Beach, or to Palm Beach. Sorry, it's not West Palm Beach. It's Palm Beach, where Mar-a-Lago is. And kissed the ring and sucked the mushroom dick, I guess. And now he's back in Trump's good graces. And he will not say one word against him. So today, after the vote to oust Liz Cheney, there was a meeting in the Oval Office. It was the first time President Joe Biden met with the congressional leadership. That would be the Speaker and the House Minority Leader, Nancy Pelosi and Kevin McCarthy, and the Senate Leader, Chuck Schumer, and the Minority Leader, Turtle McConnell. So the four of them meet ostensibly to talk about everything, but mostly infrastructure. At the end of the meeting, you know, McCarthy and McConnell come out and they're doing their thing for the cameras. But McCarthy said something quite interesting. He said this.
I don't think anybody is questioning the legitimacy of the presidential election. I think that is all over with. We're sitting here with the president today.
Really? Well, talk to Donald Trump. Talk to your caucus. Talk to everybody who just voted to throw Liz Cheney out of her leadership position, because they're all saying the election was stolen. It was a fraud. And McCarthy just wants to be speaker, so he'll say anything he needs to say at any time of the day, any day of the week. It's ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. None of these people, can you believe a word out of their mouths? Liz Cheney, I think, understands the difference between truth and a lie, and she'll tell you the truth, even if it may be unpopular with her base. So that happened today. Keep in mind, remember that Kevin McCarthy quote, because I have something to share with you in a few minutes. But then I want to get to the hearings that went on today. There were a couple of them. And I don't have information, much information, really, on the hearing about in the Senate Appropriations Committee on domestic violent extremism. But I'm glad they held that hearing today. Hopefully I'll find some information about it and can share it with you tomorrow. But it seems that most of the Twitterati were live tweeting the other hearing. That was the House Oversight Committee. And there, the hearing was titled The Capitol Insurrection, Unexplained Delays and Unanswered Questions. And oh boy, was this ever... Well, fireworks were flying. So let me share a couple of, and I've got video too, so I can share a couple of videos with you. Let's start with Ro Khanna, congressman from the San Jose area, who has turned out to be just a great progressive leader. So Ro Khanna is asking the questions here, and the person testifying is Christopher Miller. Christopher Miller was Donald Trump's last acting Secretary of Defense. And Ro Khanna had some tough questions for him. So this happened today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Secretary Miller, I have never been more offended on this committee by a witness statement than yours. Ooh. You were more concerned about defending your own reputation and justifying your own actions than the sanctity of this Capitol and the sanctity of our democracy.
Yeah.
Have you no sense of accountability? No sense of shame? Secretary Miller, I want to ask you today, will you at the very least apologize to the American public for what happened on your watch?
Yeah.
I want to highlight the incredible job that the members of our armed forces and the civilians.
Secretary Miller,
no,
I agree with you about the armed forces.
That is the
Secretary Miller, it's my time. your pugnacious style is not going to override the democratic process. Learn to respect it. My question isn't about our troops or our armed forces. Everyone recognizes they're extraordinary. My question is about your incompetence in leading them. Will you apologize to the American public for what happened on your watch? Will you apologize to the troops for what happened on your watch?
The Department of Defense and our members of the armed forces performed magnificently on January 6th.
No one is questioning what they did. By questioning what you did. Is it your testimony that you refuse to apologize to the American public for what happened?
Yes.
I stand by every decision I made on January 6th.
You, you did everything perfectly. Just like the president said, he did everything perfectly in his calls. Is that your testimony? You did everything perfectly, no mistakes?
Right.
I want to highlight again that the armed forces should only be used for domestic
testimony that you did everything perfectly? Is that your view?
I am the most critical person. I'm a career
Oh, my God. So that's that clip. But wait, there was more. So let me play for you the continuation of this, because Ro Khanna was on a roll. So it continued.
Did you or anyone in your office ever try to get a hold of President Trump on January 6th?
No.
I did not. I have no idea about it.
Your awareness that anyone in your office in the Department of Defense try to get a hold of the president?
No.
Not that I'm aware of.
You testified that things are like a video game, aren't like a video game, and that we can't quickly move troops. What explains the 36-minute delay from when you ordered the National Guard to that order being received? What explains 36 minutes?
What 36 minutes are you referring to?
Before the order was understood.
Oh, my God.
You ordered the authorization, and 36 minutes later. Are you not aware of that timeline? And everyone in the country is aware that it took 36 minutes. What explains that delay?
I'd say he's playing dumb, but he's not playing.
I've seen so many timelines and inaccurate information.
Oh, you are in charge of the whole department. Senator Blunt has questioned in a hearing that every American watched why it took 36 minutes.
Yes.
And you don't know that it took 36 minutes before you authorized something for it to actually be implemented?
What 36 minutes
are you referring to?
At 3 o'clock, he gave the order.
It is unbelievable.
How can you talk about this being, you being doing everything perfect when you're not even aware of the 36 minutes that took place before you were...
Historians and members still argue about who landed where and when on June 6th, 1994.
This is not arguing about who landed when and where. It's saying, here's what happened. You said, okay, the National Guard should go out. It took 36 minutes before that order was implemented.
Yeah.
And you're saying you didn't know that it took 36 minutes? Senators know. Congress people know. Every journalist knows. And you, who made the order, doesn't know? That's worse than if you knew and would explain why it didn't happen. And then you're here telling us that everything happened perfectly and you're not willing to apologize.
Yeah.
And the goal to hide behind our troops, who are extraordinarily honorable, it's you who's let them down. I can't believe we have someone like you in that role. Had someone like you.
Had
your,
someone.
Your whole testimony is no reflection. I mean, I thought if you came here, if you apologized, instead it's total self-promotion. All you're trying to do is cover your own reputation.
That's the last thing it is.
That's the last thing it is. In case you've just joined us, that was Trump's final acting Secretary of Defense, who he put in place to do his, I guess, his dirty work. What a piece of shit he is. By the way, let me play you one clip of him. I think this was from his opening testimony. Again, this again is Christopher Miller. He blamed the media for what happened.
I want to remind you and the American public that during that time, there was irresponsible commentary by the media about a possible military coup, or that advisors to the president were advocating the declaration of martial law.
Oh my God.
I was also very cognizant of the fears and concerns about the prior use of the military in June 2020 response to the
protests. What? That's enough of him. And what that is, because we heard reports about this, that they were worried about the optics of the military coming in to quell the uprising, the optics. That's that guy. So that happened. There was more. Paul Gosar of Arizona. Boy, what a piece of shit he is. And it went on like that. It was contentious. It was nasty. It was ugly. And, suffice it to say, nothing much was done to make things any better, to get at the truth, because they're still denying the truth. And that Christopher Miller guy, just reprehensible. The way he argued with the questioners, it's it just makes my blood curl, my skin curl, it gives me the creeps. And I'll tell you something. I would play the Paul Gosar clip. This guy is frightening, but you already knew that. Even his family has warned us about him. His family says this guy should not be in Congress. He's just really bad news. So that happened today. Let's see. I got the Rokhan. I got the Paul Gosar. I don't want to play that. All right. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We are going to take a very quick break. Actually, I'm going to play for you a song, because I said, remember the whole Kevin McCarthy thing. This is a guy who, I wonder if he's a Gemini. You know, Geminis are got dual personalities, because I think the left side of McCarthy doesn't know what the right side is saying. He just so badly wants to be speaker. Well, Kevin McCarthy is the subject of a new song, a new parody song from our friends Founder Sing. And I had two to choose from yesterday. There was a Randy Rainbow, and this one I went with the Randy Rainbow. But today, we're going to do this one because it's, well, it is timely and topical today. So, yeah, this is Founder Sing featuring the one and only Kevin McCarthy. All right, take it away, Founders. Here we go.
Know your tweets as you were leaving, but I guess that's just the way elections go. Unless there's fraud, which always means that you got hosed. Yes, it blows.
Everybody sing.
After January sorrow, kissed the ring at Mar-a-Lago, and I swore allegiance to your horror show. And now we're passing laws so black and brown can't fold. You are not yours. Take a ship back for more. Cause the truth is just for babies. Your big lie is now the way the story goes. You're our face, but there are lots of right-wing shows. Twitter blows.
For you it does. Uh-oh. Oh, that was it. A fly landed on Kevin McCarthy's head, and that's how the video ended. And one more time, I just want you to hear what Kevin McCarthy said today outside of the Oval Office right after they finished meeting with the president.
I don't think anybody is questioning the legitimacy of the presidential election. I think that is all over with. We're sitting here with the president today.
Hey, Donald, you hear that? Wonder what he thinks about that. All right. Quick timeout. Take care of a little business on the Progressive Voices Network, and we'll be back with John M. Barry, who wrote the book on the 1918 pandemic to see how we measure up. All right. While Progressive Voices is in that break, I'm going to run another ad for my lovely paintings. Should you need a gift for Father's Day? Father's Day is just a month away. I can help. Here we go. Pardon the interruption while I tell you a little story. I literally hadn't picked up a paintbrush since seventh grade, but I was bored during the pandemic, so I bought some paints, and I haven't looked back since. I shared a few beach sunset paintings online when I got my first request. A friend asked, "Can you paint my cat, Buddy?" I said, "Probably not, but I'd try," and I surprised us both. Someone else then asked if I'd try to capture Char, the dog. And wow, I like this one even better. So I started painting all of my dogs from through the years, and others asked, and now I've kind of got a mini business going painting pet portraits. They make the perfect gift for any pet lover in your life, or even for yourself. The only bad thing about loving our fur babies is that we tend to outlive them. Now you can keep a beautiful reminder of your precious pets forever. Interested in more? Send me an email, nicole@nicolesandler.com, and we'll talk. And if you'd like to see more of my paintings, just go to nicolesandler.com/pandemic-painting. Thanks for looking.
Are you or a loved one suffering from foxitis? A serious medical condition affecting many older Americans and people who are hoarding canned goods in their sheds. Symptoms of foxitis include irritable gut valve, Bartteromononucleosis, swollen Ainsley, blood in your Ducey, Ingram toenail, Janine pyroids, Tucker carcinoma, Kaylee McAnal cyst, and Schonertal warts. Thankfully, there is a cure. Introducing Off, from the makers of Mute and Change the Channel.
From the makers of Newt and Change the Channel. I stole that from Stephen Colbert. I didn't play the audio because I mean the video because I don't want a copyright violation, but that was too good not to share. All right. So I told you we're going to speak with John M. Barry about the pandemic. Here we are, you know, 13, 14 months into it. Just so you know, I taped it this morning. I had a little malfunction. This is why I run redundant recordings, but the video did not record. So today you get the audio version of the interview with John Barry. And here it goes. John M. Barry returns to the show. He's a New York Times bestselling author whose books have won lots of awards. The one we're going to talk about today, The Great Influenza, The Story of the Deadliest Pandemic in History, won an award in 2005 as the year's outstanding book on science or medicine, obviously dealing with the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. John Barry, first of all, welcome back to the show. You may not remember because I know you do a lot of these, but we spoke almost exactly a year ago. It was May 6th of 2020 when you first appeared on the show to share your expertise on the last global pandemic to help us understand what's happening now. So I wonder, in the year that's passed, have your thoughts on the differences and similarities between now and then changed at all?
Well, first, thanks for having me back. Probably not in that sense. I think by last May, it was already apparent, both differences and similarities, with the possible exception, I'm not sure exactly when the concerns about long COVID started to surface. Maybe not quite that early.
Nope.
That is another similarity, and we had exactly the same kinds of things happening at the 1918 pandemic. That supports the idea that at least part of the problem is not the virus itself, but the immune system. Most of the other things were already clear.
Happy to run through them if you.
Well, sure. But I want to tell everyone that you did write another op-ed that appears in the Washington Post. It was in Monday's May 10th edition, titled "The 1918 Pandemic Tells Us That We Can't Celebrate the End of COVID Yet." And I guess that's the place to start, because lots of people are. I mean, they're acting as if we're free and clear. We're not, are we?
No, I mean, on the one hand, I'm actually much more optimistic than I have been at any other time in the course of the outbreak. You know, for the United States, but for the first time, the U.S. really is a bright spot. Mm-hmm. For the U.S., things look pretty good going into the future with a couple of caveats. The most important is the variant. The virus is circulating around the world in a lot of places worse than it ever has. And every time it infects somebody, it has the opportunity to mutate in a very, very nasty direction.
Yeah.
So that's one caveat. The other is hubris. If we really think it's completely over and let down our guard too much, I mean, that's what happened to India.
Yeah.
I mean, India, it was hubris. They did pretty well, very well. In the first wave, got completely overconfident. And now the numbers there are absolutely frightening, because as probably all your listeners know, the actual reported death tolls are a fraction of the numbers of people were dying. And oddly enough, in 1918, India was extraordinarily hard hit. Probably at least 10 million deaths in India alone in 1918, possibly as many as 20 million in India alone.
Wow. Yeah, the footage, the pictures coming out of India are just frightening, depressing, scare. I mean, everything every word you can describe, it's just overwhelming. I just saw somebody on Twitter a little while ago, nobody I know, but who said, all right, now COVID is personal. It took both my parents in India in the last 2 weeks. So it's just horrible. There's a paragraph in your Washington Post op-ed that begins with, hubris is not our friend. You talk about India, but you also mention my state. I live in Florida. And you single out, that's the reaction I get. You single out our governor. His name is Ron DeSantis. I've come to call him Ron Death Sentence. Everything he's doing is back-ass words. And thank you for calling him out, because you say these are not good signs. The restriction, he's canceled all restrictions by any local government. He's driving the cruise industry out of South Florida because he will not allow any kind of vaccine passport mandate to be used.
Right.
So you say these are not good signs and all could lead to a resurgence of infections.
Well, I mean, I think it's pretty clear DeSantis is running for president and the Republican Party likes science deniers.
Yeah.
I can remember writing, I've written a lot of op-eds and commented a lot in the court, but I can remember last summer when the cases in Florida were skyrocketing, and I was comparing it to the situation in Europe where, I mean, Florida was having over 10,000 cases a day. I think their peak was around 13,000. And at the same time, Italy, the entire country of Italy, was having 200 cases a day.
Right.
The vaccinations are hugely important. In a lot of southern states, they are well below the national average. We're in the mid-40s nationally, mid-40 percentile nationally. A lot of southern states are in the low 30s. And then you cancel the possibility of a local government imposing some kind of restriction, and you're asking for trouble. If the vaccinations continue the way they have been nationally, and I say I'm more optimistic than ever, I would expect football stadiums in the fall to have no restrictions. And as an ex-football coach, I kind of like that. I did that for a couple of years when I first got out of school. But we are running a risk, and that risk is very real. And regionally, more than nationally, at this point.
Right. Yeah, because that's where it will. There'll be flare-ups in, you know, certain regions. I mean, we saw it in the Dakotas after the motorcycle rally that they had last summer, the things like that. That's why, right. You know, Florida, even though I'm vaccinated, I rarely left my home for about 13 months. I still don't go out a lot. And when I do, I still wear a mask because I don't believe that people are taking it seriously here in the state. And our governor has no clue what he's doing. Sort of like, you know, the guy he's trying to emulate, who I believe is responsible for our situation here in the U.S. being as bad as it was. It didn't have to be. We didn't have to have over 500,000 people die in the U.S., right? Do you? I place the blame on Trump. Do you?
Unfortunately, yeah. You know, I've often compared what we've done with what the countries that have done the best job in the world, where they are. Mm-hmm. And maybe the best comparison, it's not just the Asian countries like, you know, South Korea and Thailand and even North Vietnam. You can argue that their culture is radically different than the United States, and that we couldn't get away in the United States. Government couldn't do what they did. But look at Australia.
Uh-huh.
Australia is entirely a Western culture.
Mm-hmm.
Some people have compared it to Texas in terms of the way people think there. Australia is 909 deaths.
Wow.
They've had four deaths since the middle of October.
Wow.
If you adjust for population, then that would be the equivalent of 12,000 deaths in the United States. And we've got 570,000 deaths.
Yeah.
Australia's done it right. Now, the population is still vulnerable if the virus were to get loose there. So they need to vaccinate to prevent that. There are a lot of Americans who are dead because the government did a horrific job.
Yep.
And there's no other way to say it.
Right. So we're seeing this turnaround, thankfully. We have adults now in charge who are doing things the right way. And so we are getting vaccinated, although there is this vaccine hesitancy out there that I just don't understand. But that goes with American society. We have the anti-vaxxer crowd anyway. And then you have our political situation, where Republicans have made getting vaccinated a political thing, the same way they did with wearing masks, instead of putting health concerns ahead of politics, which is really frustrating. It's got to be frustrating for you as someone who's done so much research on pandemics like this. I'm going back to the book, The Great Influenza. This was dealing with the 1918 Spanish flu, but that was a flu. It was an influenza virus, different from a coronavirus, right? What is the main difference between?
Well, I mean, I'm sure you don't want to get into the molecular biology,
right,
and the binding, where it binds and so forth and so on. The reality is there are a lot of similarities. The mode of transmission is identical.
Huh. Okay.
You know, it binds to cells in the upper respiratory tract, can also bind to cells start out deep in the lung, which is unusual for influenza. That's one of the reasons 1918 was so deadly. You could start out with viral pneumonia. The 1918 was much more virulent.
Really?
Nobody was saying it was a hoax, or nobody believed it was a hoax. The government actually tried to say it because we were at war. They were trying to. But people were dying sometimes 12 hours after the first symptoms.
Wow.
Roughly 2/3 of the dead were people aged 18 to 45. Over 90% of the excess mortality was people younger than 65 years old. So in that sense, it was radically different from what we're having today. The case mortality rate in the United States was probably about 2 to 2.5%. In much of the world, it was considerably higher. It was probably around 6 to 8%. You know, we're still probably well under 1% of the case fatality for COVID-19. But one of the biggest differences, in addition to the ones I already cited, is the duration. You know, incubation moves so much faster than COVID-19.
Hmm.
The incubation period, how long you're sick, and also those cities that imposed, you know, influenza came in very discrete waves. The waves we've had have been more like swells with a constant higher, you know, you know, like a white cap on top of a swell.
Right.
Much steady. In 1918, they were very distinct. And the disease would go through any particular city in you know, as little as 5 or 6 weeks, no longer than 10 weeks. And then it disappeared almost entirely. And those cities that imposed restrictions, most of them, but not all of them, like New York, didn't do anything. Those restrictions were only in place for 3, 4, or 5 weeks, almost never longer than that. So when the disease disappeared, you know, nobody had any reason to take any precaution because the disease was gone. And the duration of the restrictions was short, so life went back to normal very, very rapidly. Was exactly like it had been before the pandemic. What we've gone through in terms of a psychological stress, I mean, much deadlier in 1918, much more intense, much more tragic, because there are so many more people killed on a per capita basis. But the stress that we're going through and the economic impact is actually probably, certainly the economic impact is much greater today.
Right. Well, just the stakes are larger. The economy's, the world economy is so much larger. But I'm curious. I want to go back to the fact that it just disappeared. I mean, this is what Trump was, I guess, hoping for without any scientific evidence to back him up. He was saying one day, miraculously, it'll just disappear. It'll just go away. Which I thought was ridiculous, but you're saying that's kind of what happened in 1918.
Well, they didn't have a vaccine. In a technical sense, let's say there was no vaccine whatsoever.
Right.
In a technical sense, sooner or later, pretty much everybody's going to be infected.
Right.
And they will have some immunity. It's not clear how long it would last from natural infection. The vaccine actually gives you better protection than being infected with the virus does. So when that happens, that's herd immunity.
Uh-huh.
And the virus would continue to circulate, but it's basically burned through all the available fuel. It will continue to mutate. Eventually, you'll get a virus that is mutated enough that the immune protection from people who's already been infected is not going to protect them that much, and then it would come back in another wave. You know, so technically he was right. It would more or less disappear even if we had done nothing. The problem is if we did that, there would probably be 2 million, at least 2 million dead Americans
right
before that happened, and it would take quite a while for that to work its way through the system, or, you know, through the ecology or whatever,
right,
environment,
right,
whatever you So, yeah, I mean, he was right. It would eventually disappear, but it wasn't going to disappear
once. Right. But it did in 1918. You're saying that was the lifespan of the virus is shorter, or it's just a different?
Yeah, well, it moves faster. You know, the serial transmission is faster. And it's not quite as contagious as COVID-19.
Okay.
The reproductive number, a phrase that probably all your listeners by now have heard many times, for the 1918 pandemic was generally about 1.8.
Mm-hmm.
The reproductive number for COVID is 2.5. Wow. That may not sound like a big difference, but it's astronomical. This is a much more contagious virus. And then the variants that developed are probably more than the 2.5. So that's why in 1918, you needed a lot fewer people to be infected before you got your attained herd immunity. And I don't want people to think that herd immunity means the virus disappears.
Right.
That's not what it means. It would continue to circulate. It's not going to die out. There are always going to be people who can be infected. Plus, COVID-19, which was also true with the 1918 virus, has an animal reservoir. The 1918 virus infected every mammal. I mean, we know that it infected dolphins, even. You know, moose, tigers, cats, dogs. This virus also moves very easily between humans and animals. So you have an animal reservoir where it can continue to mutate. And even if you successfully protect the human population, that means the virus is sooner or later going to jump back to humans in a different enough form that it can spread. That doesn't mean that we would have another situation like we faced in the last year. Once we're vaccinated or naturally infected, your immune system is very likely going to be able to handle the virus much, much better. Even if it's mutated to the extent that it can still make you sick, it's very likely that you're not going to get as sick.
Right.
That it would be a much more mild attack. I mean, the virus is here to stay.
This is going to be like an annual thing, like a flu, where every year we get a flu shot. Are we going to need to get a COVID shot, or do we just not know yet?
Well, we don't exactly know yet. My personal view, and I think it's probably widely shared, and again, I'm not a scientist, I'm an historian.
Right.
You know, I talk to a lot of scientists, and I work with scientists. Maybe not every year, because this virus moves more slowly and mutates more slowly than influenza. Influenza mutates at least 3 times the speed of this virus, and maybe more rapidly than that. What that means is we would probably need future shots. Whether we would need one every year, that's arguable at this point. My guess is it would be every 2, 3, 4 years the virus would change enough that we would need another shot. There have been studies of the coronaviruses that cause colds that looked over a 15-year time frame at neutralizing antibodies, and they demonstrated that over a 15-year time frame, these cold-causing coronaviruses, the neutralizing antibodies don't protect against them. Because the virus continues to change, you know, and there's a gradual decline in the ability of the neutralizing antibodies to bind to that virus. You know, that's sort of the natural history of most pathogens would be similar to that. And there's no reason to think that this virus is going to be any different than the way other viruses behave.
I'm looking for parallels between what we're experiencing now and the 1918 pandemic. There are some who say, you know, they have a belief that history repeats itself. And if you subscribe to that theory, maybe we can expect another roaring 20s to be on the horizon. Do you subscribe to that?
You know, people who connect the pandemic with the roaring 20s are vastly overstating the impact of the pandemic. They ignore what came. The roaring 20s didn't start in 1920.
Right.
1919 was one of the most disruptive years in American history. You had violent, paralyzing strikes in the coal and steel industries. You had a general strike in Seattle. You had a police strike in Boston. You had race riots in 26 cities. You had an attempted assassination of the Attorney General of the United States. You had all these things. You also had 4 million soldiers coming out of the army without jobs.
Oh, yeah.
You had the American farms fed all of Europe during the war. The agricultural prices collapsed. So we had in 1920 and 1921 a very severe recession. Warren Harding, who was elected president in 1920, his campaign was for a return to normalcy. Mm-hmm. So all these things occurred before the roaring 20s got going. This pretty significant recession ended, then you got the boom. We're in a situation that's entirely different. For one thing, we already had our recession caused by the pandemic. We have a lot of pent-up demand, and I also left out the impact of 20 million dead in World War I. The Roaring Twenties was not simply an American phenomenon. It was in Sydney, Australia, Berlin, Paris, London, and the U.S. only lost 50,000 soldiers in World War I. Those countries lost 10 million soldiers. So, and 10 million civilians also died in the war. So all those things contributed to the attitude of the Roaring Twenties, which was not only an economic boom, But it was also, you know, the writers referred to as the lost generation. There was a sense of ennui and fatalism, and that came, I think the pandemic probably contributed a little bit to that, maybe significantly, but I think the war was a lot more important.
Gotcha.
You know, now we have pent-up demand. Try to get a reservation at a restaurant in an area where restaurants have fully reopened. We have the stimulus spending. Mm-hmm. You know, we still have a lot of jobs that haven't come back. But, yeah, I would think that we're going to have a pretty rapid and good recovery. I certainly hope so, economically. And that will be related to coming out of the pandemic. But the Roaring Twenties was not a response to the 1918 pandemic. There was so much more going on.
And there usually is. We tend to try to oversimplify things when we make those comparisons. Anyway, the book is The Great Influenza, the story of the deadliest pandemic in history. Do you think once we're past this, that 1918 will still be the deadliest pandemic in history, or will we COVID take over?
Even if we had done nothing, you know, worldwide in 1918, the death toll was probably at least 50 million people worldwide.
Oh, my.
It could have been. There's a Nobel laureate that thinks it, and some modern epidemiologists think it might have been as many as 100 million. And if the world population was 1.6 billion.
Right.
So if you're just for population, that would be equal to 225 to 450 million people dead today. So that's, you know,
that's
if we
astounding.
Had done nothing at all in this pandemic, you wouldn't even begin to approach those numbers. The virus today is simply not as dangerous, is just not as deadly as the 1918 pandemic.
Wow.
God.
That's amazing, too, because when you think about it, you know, the naysayers on the right, they're going, it's a flu. It's like the flu. Well, in this case, the flu was horribly deadly. So you can't just poo-poo the flu. You think we should, in addition to getting vaccinated for COVID, should still get vaccinated against the flu every year.
Yes. I mean, clearly.
Yeah. All right. Well, it's fascinating. I will link on the blog where I post today's show to your Washington Post op-ed titled The 1918 Pandemic Tells Us That We Can't Celebrate the End of COVID Yet. And the warning is just be careful, right?
Yeah.
Use common sense and stay safe and don't listen to Ron Santos.
And again, I am optimistic. I expect to be going to football games in the fall and have crowds around me. But it's not over. And overconfidence is dangerous.
John M. Barry, thank you so much for coming back on the show and bringing us up to date. This is going to be with us for a while, and we just have to temper our expectations and take care to be careful. Some people won't, but we can.
Thank you.
John M. Barry, you know, if I could do this show the way I'd love to, I would have segued from that interview right into Lenny Kravitz, It Ain't Over Till It's Over. You know, because I would love to do that music newsy thing, but I can't because YouTube would copyright violate me again. Anyway, we got a few minutes left. I want to share with you one other thing and warn you that I might get suspended from Facebook again. I'm behaving myself on YouTube, but on Facebook, I got into it last night with some really fucked up people. If you've listened to the show for any amount of time, you know that one of my guilty pleasures is that I watch the soap opera General Hospital. I have for decades. I mean, I've gone for years at a time without watching it, but you can miss a year and then come back the next day and you can kind of pick up where you were. Anyway, I enjoy it for the campiness of it because it is so over the top and ridiculous. It's my escape from reality. But yesterday, and then there's this General Hospital fake Facebook group, and why I joined it, I don't know, but I like to read the comments every now and then. And yesterday I started seeing all these comments about how dare they bring race into the show, and it's just an outrage. And I started fighting with people before I ever saw the episode. Well, I'm going to play for you just the audio because I don't want to get copyright violated. But who's talking is there are two black women. One is and I can't think of her name. One is the police commissioner, and the other is another woman. They both have teenage children, TJ and Trina, teenage, of course, black children. The police commissioner, black woman, in a previous episode, found herself holding a gun on a white teenager who was holding a gun on her, and she wound up not shooting him. But this is the scene. This is just one of the scenes that in which it came up. But this is what happened on General Hospital yesterday.
I heard that you de-escalated a highly volatile situation to make sure that no one got hurt. And by no one, I mean Cameron.
Here, I'll put up. I came onto the scene with my gun drawn.
Ooh.
And there was Cameron Weber pointing a gun straight at me. I ordered him to put the gun down, but he didn't respond.
Oh, no.
The look on his face, he was frozen. Just pure panic. Four of my officers arrived, and I ordered them to stand down, but Cameron was still holding the gun. I just remember thinking I would do whatever it took to...
to keep him from getting shot, yeah. Have you ever been in some kind of situation like that before?
Oh, sure I have. Baltimore, other places. But the kids... the men and the women, they didn't look like Cameron.
Whoa.
They look like TJ and Trina.
I don't really have any good...
Okay, so the scene ends there, but there's another scene later on. I wonder if I'm not going to be able to find it quickly enough. But basically, they continue the conversation, and she says, I believe that if... I had gotten there, you know, if it was a kid who looked like Trina or TJ, and I got there a few minutes later and the officers had pulled their weapons, I wouldn't have been able to stop them. I got to tell you, I applaud them for this storyline. I really do. I think it's awesome that they broached this subject. Here's a little bit more. Okay, so here is Trina talking to Cameron, the kid who held the gun.
I know how lucky you are to be alive.
Ooh.
Yeah. We didn't know why Cameron had the gun.
Again.
I just knew that I needed to stop things from escalating. As a mother, I wanted to make sure to keep him safe for his mother.
Thank God you were there. Things could have ended up very differently.
Yeah. The fact that hasn't escaped me. It saddens and sickens me to say it, but if Cameron's skin had been a different color... and my officers got there first, I might not have had the chance to talk them down.
Ooh.
He might not have been given the benefit of the doubt.
It's an unfortunate reality, one that I can't even believe we're still dealing with to this day.
So, again, you know, my stupid dope opera dealt with this very serious situation. And I got to tell you, on Facebook, the pearl clutching is just over the top. People are like, I will never watch this show again. And then there are others. I mean, I said something. Let me see if I can find my little rant. Here's what I wrote. I know it's not necessary to announce my departure from this group, but I'll do it anyway for my own self-respect. Shame on the idiots who call dealing with race problems, especially of cops shooting unarmed black people, quote, playing the race card, which someone posted. I wrote, it's called reality. Shame on those of you. Whoops. Shame on those of you who can't see what's right in front of you. And God forbid it interrupts your stupid dope opera. I watch it for the camp nature of it. And I'm heartened when they take on an issue that needs to be dealt with, especially knowing there are people like the Neanderthals in this group who can't see what's right in front of you. Bye now. And then, you know, a lot of people thankfully agreed with me and said, please don't leave the group. We need reasonable people in here. And others are like, I'll never watch this show again. How dare they interrupt every time they interrupt with news. If I want to watch the news, I can watch the news. It doesn't belong in my dope opera. Sorry, they say soap opera. Oh, my God. Now, I get that I've walked into a strange world in the world of soap operas. Thankfully, there are reasonable people in there who get it and who are applauding them for dealing with this storyline. But the stupid is just astounding. It is just incredible. And so I did call a couple of those people out individually, and I'm fully expecting for Facebook to suspend me. But there are like thousands of posts in these threads about this storyline from yesterday. So it's going to take them a while to get through them all, I guess. anyway, can't wait to see what they do today. Hey. All right. With that, we're done for the day. Tomorrow, I'm trying to remember. I did book somebody good for tomorrow, and I can't remember who it was. So you're just going to have to tune in and find out. All right. Okay. With that, we're done. I will see you back here tomorrow. Oh, tomorrow's Thursday. Duh. We have Howie Klein tomorrow. He's back. Howie Klein tomorrow. So lots to talk about. All right. Thanks for listening, everyone. See you then. Bye.